It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back to Alaska Tracks, your favorite program where you can listen to interviews with veteran Alaskan outdoorsmen and women telling stories about their lives and adventures. Hi, I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host for today's program. We've been on the air for about 2 months now. I'm hearing from more and more listeners all the time. They all seem to be loving the show, and I hope you are too. I've really enjoyed working with the folks here at KFAR. I also want to thank our sponsors for keeping us on the air. Please thank them the next time you go into their place of business. Today's featured guest is Sam Harbo. I hardly know where to start with Sam. He was a professor at the University of Alaska. He served 10 years on the Board of Game. When I worked at the Department of Fish and Game, Sam was widely respected by everyone. He had a level of wisdom rarely seen in our field. Sam's interview ran for about 80 minutes, and essentially all of it was profound. I normally have to cut and paste sections of these interviews to provide you with good material. Not so with Sam. Almost every word is worth your time. We will get 3 episodes out of this one interview. But enough from me. You didn't tune in to listen to me. Let's go to Sam and hear about his early years and formal education.
I was born and raised on a farm in southern Minnesota. I'm 76 years old. I stayed on the farm until I went away to college at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln in 1947. The only reason leaving the state of Minnesota was the fact that the Navy had sent me on a scholarship. When I was growing up, hunting and fishing and trapping were a way of life with us on the farm. I can remember trapping, mainly for mink and muskrat, but also for skunk and weasel. And some of the prices, on reflection, were really high at that time. I can remember, I think it was in 1946, that I got a top of $3 a pelt for muskrat and $50 for one of the mink that I caught. I also had some other experiences, though, with skunks that weren't nearly as productive. In southern Minnesota, they had tiled to drain marshes many years ago. And some of those marshes had dried with the exposed tile, and they were excellent places for skunk to den. I would usually go out and check the trap line before I would go to grade school or to high school. And I can remember one morning I had a big skunk in one of the traps set at the mouth of an exposed tile. Well, I got up in back of the tile and figured I could pull the trap and get the skunk out, backing him out of the tile, and shoot him with a cutoff 22 cartridge right in the skull so it wouldn't damage anything. Well, unfortunately, the skunk decided to liberally doze his tail and flip it over his back right into my face. Oh my, I can remember just the eyes burning something fierce. After a while, the smell didn't bother me too much. I thought maybe I'd gotten rid of it. I went home and washed up really well. My dad came in from doing the chores and said, "Oh my gosh." And he said, "Well, I've washed well." And he said, "We better wash again." So I washed again and I went to school. And that was the first day that I only spent about 5 minutes in school before the teacher sent me back home. But even then, a skunk pelt was about $6. And in 1946, that was a very nice price for furs. It just amazes me to look now and see the price of furs and compare it to what the purchasing power I had in 1945, 46. Wow. In 46 in particular, in Minnesota, we had gone through a period of wet years after a whole number of dry years. So a lot of the marshes had dried. And when that water came back in, the vegetation just proliferated and the muskrat populations were just unbelievable. There were 3 of us that did some trapping together. And I can remember one day, I think the take was 120-some muskrats. It was unbelievable, that population. Anyway, my interest in hunting, fishing, and trapping carried over when I went to college. Unfortunately, the University of Nebraska did not have a wildlife management program or a very good biology program. So I opted for a soils program. when I graduated from Nebraska, I went into the Navy. And when I got out in 1951 in California, I enrolled in a master's program at the University of California at Berkeley, mainly because of the fact that they had on their faculty A. Starker Leopold, who was a well-known name in the field of wildlife management. He was my major prof, and I stayed there until January of 1956, when I went in to talk with Dr. Leopold one Monday morning to get the final instructions for my research on my master's project. He told me that he was going to New Zealand for 6 months the following week. And when he got back from New Zealand, he was going to Mexico City for a year to write a book on the wildlife of Mexico. Well, there went my major professor at the time when I probably needed him more than any other time. So when I could get in my comments, I said, would you please write a letter of reference for me to the leader, Alaska Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, University of Alaska Fairbanks. And so I immediately transferred to Fairbanks as soon as the semester was over in January of 56. I can remember arriving about 2:30 in the afternoon on a Pan Am flight and was met by the leader, Dr. John Buckley. It was a crisp, beautiful January afternoon, but also about 130 degrees colder than when I had left San Francisco. But even so, I didn't regret it one moment, nor have I ever regretted it since. In retrospect, I'm very glad that A. Starker Leopold went to New Zealand, and that only came about because he had been to a cocktail party the Friday before I talked with them on a Monday morning. And a wealthy friend of his had a yacht in New Zealand, which prompted A. Starker Leopold to decide 6 months in New Zealand would be a good thing to do. Starker's excuse for being able to do that was the fact that he had a doctoral student working on red deer in New Zealand. When I came to Alaska and started then to complete my master's program up here, I decided I wanted to work on one of the fur bearers, and the one that really interested me the most was the one that I also found most challenging in Minnesota, and that was the mink. I was able to get a research project going on mink in the Hooslea area along the Koyukuk, and I spent 2 years on that project. The first year, I went out there with Robert Rausch, who was also a graduate student at the time, who had initially started a mink research project out there in 1955, but then decided that he was going to be switching over to a moose project. So I then took over that research project. And in addition to doing research work on mink in the Hooslea and Koyukuk area, I also went down into southeastern and looked at the mink populations and the effect of trapping in southeast Alaska. And it was very interesting. As far as I could tell, in the Koyukuk area, trapping had essentially no effect on the mink populations. They seemed to fluctuate irrespective of what the trappers did. That was not the case at all in southeastern. In southeastern, the trapping pressure could be very intense and extremely effective in the intertidal zone. Previous game managers had decided that there should only be alternate trapping seasons in southeast because of the tremendous takes that could be afforded in one season. As far as I could tell, that was a very sound practice from an economic point of view, because outfitting a fishing boat so that it could go and anchor in places where the trappers would operate was somewhat expensive. So it was best to try and reduce that expense to only a one-year output every 2 years, but in effect getting 2 years harvest in 1 year. So we continued with the every other year trapping. I don't know if that's still continuing, but it seemed a very reasonable practice at that particular time because there was intensive interest in mink trapping. In retrospect, it's interesting to compare today's fur prices with what I experienced in 45, 46, and 47. The purchasing power has certainly decreased. And it's unfortunate our attitude worldwide is what it is in the developed country towards the use of fur, because it is such a valuable renewable resource.
your research there at Huslia, what did you find and how was it received by the locals? Were they glad to know that people were studying the animals that they depended on, and were they receptive to the results?
The results that I got were somewhat ambiguous. It was pretty obvious that the trappers weren't influencing the population, because monitoring the catch and looking at the number of tagged mink that they got back was so small that they just could not have impacted the population. What really did influence it is still, to my mind, an open question. I think one of the difficulties that mink experience is, of course, the basic food supply, but the conditions of freeze-up and what the snow conditions are and how quickly the water levels drop under a cover of ice, because once the water level drops, after you've got a good coating of ice on there, you get just as miles of areas along these places where the mink can actually hunt under the ice, and they're totally protected. But the snow conditions early and the freeze-up, I think, really impacts the micrateen population. And if there's good survival of micrateens, then probably the mink do pretty well as well. So I think good snow conditions for mice probably also mean that it's going to be good snow conditions for mink as well. It was a mixed bag as to the way the locals received it. Roush had been out the previous year, and then I had been there for the next 2 years. A couple of years after that, the mink harvest wasn't particularly good, but also the mink trapping effort was dropping, so that the intensity wasn't there that had been there. But they blamed us for screwing it up. Well, they couldn't ever say why, but talking with one of them that was out there with me in November on the trap line, he indicated that sometimes mink just appear and just disappear. And it was the spirits that determined it. And our coming out there antagonized the spirits. This guy would go ahead and put grease on the nose of a mink before he would bring it in to skin it and so forth to appease the spirits so they didn't smell these terrible smells in the cabin from humans. So he had a completely different concept of what governed these mink populations than I did. And in his mind, I'm sure it logically followed that I had screwed up the minks. Other ones could see the usefulness of trying to figure out why mink populations did what they did. So it was a real mixed bag. It just depends on the preconceived notions that you go in with and review such a thing. But it was a really interesting experience coming from California to outdoor Alaska.
And a tiny community, too.
It was 100 and some people, probably.
Great stuff, Sam. We'll hear more from you in a minute. But first, let's go to a word from our sponsors. Okay, we're back from the sponsor break, and it's time to hear about Sam Harbo's early career and then a return to school for some specialized training. How about some other stories from your time up in Huslia? I'm sure that every day had to just be a new adventure for you.
Yeah, it really was. I can remember the second fall that I was there, when it was late enough in the season so I figured that I could take a moose and it would keep. Then I started checking each day to see whether or not I could have gotten a moose within 100 feet of the river. That was my upper limit. And I think there were 20 days in a row I could have gotten a moose within 100 feet of the river. In fact, a couple mornings, I got out of the tent because I heard sounds just right outside the tent, and there was a big bull moose that was rubbing his antlers and didn't want to go. I mean, just did not want to move. Finally, just kind of stalked off very regally. And another time, I had two camps about 20 miles apart on the river, so I could have live traps strung on the different oxbows and little ponds along the river. So I'd stay in one camp one night and then work traps down, and next day come back up. Well, at the upper end, there was a trapper's cabin, and it was owned by the Sam boys, Bergman Sam and Tony Sam. Tony Sam was a musher who won the North American also. In fact, second year that I was out there in November, he let me take his dog teams a number of times, and that was the dog team that he came back and won all three heats of the North American with. So that was a real experience. I didn't realize what kind of quality dogs I was driving, but man, they were really good. But anyway, at the upper one, where the trapper's cabin was, I had my tent set about 20 feet away from the cabin. And it was probably about 60, 70 feet back from the river. But there was a well-worn trail, of course, down to where we tied up the canoe. Well, one day, this was after it had frosted, so there was ice on the vegetation. I heard this crinkling in the morning as I was getting up, and I looked out, and there was a cow moose walking through the tall calama grasses with all the frozen dewdrops on it. I pulled the flap back, and it spooked and went down the trail. My canoe was right at the end of it. I thought, oh my God, here goes my canoe. And I don't know how it managed to do it, but it leaped it and landed in the river on the other side of the canoe. And I had about 40-some miles to go back to Huslia. And, you know, it was getting close to freeze-up. In a couple days, I would have to leave. In fact, I did leave in a couple days, and I left among the ice floes. So the ice started running fairly early, but I could see myself stuck up there with no canoe. After I completed my master's degree, I went to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service and was at Cold Bay and working with Bob Jones, who was the refuge manager. I'll never forget watching the brant and geese at Cold Bay. Bob Jones had told me that come late October, those birds are going to migrate. And he said, if you go out there repeatedly, he said, one of those days you're going to see them, all of them just getting up and circling, going up and up and up and up and up. And he said, chances are they'll come back down again and land. And so I did that. And sure enough, one day I saw all of them. Just all of them seemed to take off. And there's such a collection of waterfowl out there at the height that if something scares them all out and you've got the old-fashioned light meter, you'll see it register in the light meter. They just, so many, they just block it out. But I went out there, and one day, all of a sudden, they just took off. And they went up and up and almost out of sight. And then all of a sudden, they started coming back down. And I went out there the next day, and the same thing. I went out there the next day, they didn't come back down. The winds must have been just right to push them over to British Columbia. That's what Bob Jones told me. He said they'll go up. They know about when it should be occurring, and they'll go up and test it. And then if those winds are just right, they take off. We then went out to the Western Aleutians and did some sea otter food habits research. On our trip to Adak, Bob Jones fell and broke his leg, so he had to go back and recuperate. So then I was the caretaker for the Cold Bay Refuge for a few months until Bob could come back. I had been scheduled to take over the bear management project for the Fish and Wildlife Service at Kodiak. But then the Fish and Wildlife Service decided they were going to reorganize since the state was taking over management in January of that coming year, and decided to eliminate that particular research project. So I immediately then switched over to the new State Department of Fish and Game. My first station was in Juneau for about 3 months, getting oriented to the new Fish and Game Department. And then I moved to Nome and opened the first fish and game office in Nome, with my primary emphasis on Pacific walrus, but also trying to begin to document the status and utilization of various moose populations scattered along the west coast of Alaska, particularly in the Kobuk River area and the Noatak River area. That was a very fascinating time for a new biologist to be stationed in that part of Alaska. My wife and I spent the spring of 1959 on King Island during the walrus hunting season, the last year that the Eskimos occupied King Island on a year-round basis. The following year, I spent at Diomede, also monitoring the walrus harvest there. It was a very interesting time in Alaska because there essentially was good feeling throughout Alaska in all quarters. A person could go into a remote village and be welcome. Unfortunately, that has tended to change, partly because I think aspirations were raised to a very high degree with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or expectations that were not realized in the short term, particularly the younger Alaskans. And so I think there was a sense of frustration. The villages tended not to be as friendly as they had in the past. I think the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act accomplished a lot, but unfortunately I think it caused some serious rifts in our social fabric in the state of Alaska. And unfortunately, the Anilka battle over subsistence tended to increase that tear in our social fabric. When I started my research work on walrus for the Department of Fish and Game out of Nome, Alaska, after 2 years of collecting data, I realized that I did not have the necessary tools for adequately evaluating the data that I collected. And I realized that I needed more training in the area of statistical analysis. I decided that probably the best way of doing that was to go back to school and actually get a doctorate in statistics. My interest still basically was in biology, but I just needed those statistical tools. So when I was still a biologist at Nome, I enrolled in correspondence courses with the University of California at Berkeley and completed 3/4 of calculus courses by correspondence so that I could get up to speed on my math before I enrolled in a graduate program. I can remember getting up a little before 6 in the morning and working on my calculus correspondence courses before I went to work. When I completed those, I wrote to 2 institutions for enrolling in their doctoral programs. One was Iowa State University, and the other one was North Carolina State University. And those 2, at the time, had the recognized best applied stat programs in the country. I got accepted at both Iowa State and North Carolina State, and my inclination was to go to Iowa State, but North Carolina State had just instituted an agreement with 11 southeastern states that they would be a cooperative wildlife statistics program with their fish and game department. They had an assistantship available for a new doctoral student at that particular wildlife statistic cooperative project, which was ideal from my point of view because that's exactly why I wanted to go back to school, to learn the statistical tools for wildlife management. So I decided to go to North Carolina State and completed my doctorate degree. I came back then to the University of Alaska and joined the faculty in the Wildlife Management Department in 1964. I then was in the Wildlife Management Department and was essentially then starting to build the STAT program also at the university at the same time. So I ended up with a joint appointment in both the math and the wildlife management program. I developed some STAT courses, and as the enrollment increased, we then hired another statistician to essentially fit directly into the math department and handle about half of the STAT courses. I continued in both math and the wildlife management program throughout my tenure at the university. I was department chair of the wildlife management program for about 10 years.
As you can tell, Sam was a man of high intelligence and high integrity. He had strong beliefs, but also recognized that there were folks with equally valid views, even if they didn't agree with him. Well, that's all for today. Tune in again next week when we'll hear more from Sam Harbold.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.